Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. We have Liz Parrish, who's CEO of BioViva USA, Inc., which is committed to building gene therapies to eradicate disease and extend healthy life. You know, no big deal. She's a board member of Radish Medical Solutions and founder of Biotrove Investments and Media. She's actively involved in international educational media via the International Longevity Alliance, of which she is a board member, on which she serves as secretary. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Liz.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm always excited to talk to people.
I am excited to talk to you. I really enjoy talking to people who are ambitious and have great big visions of universes that are possible that don't currently exist. And, you know, like I just saying, you know, what you're committed to, what BioViva is committed to is a very, you know, what some may think is like science fiction, right? Or they may think it's some sort of goal that just seems wholly not possible. But you would beg to differ, right?
I would. So a lot of people think that age reversal and living more youthfully longer, many more years, is science fiction, and actually it's science fact. So we're doing these technologies already in animals and in cell culture, human cell culture. So we're really excited to actually move these into human bodies and see if we can mitigate the diseases of aging and also reverse engineer what's happening at the childhood level of disease. So there are accelerated aging symptoms that children have in some disease states, and then there's also monogenic diseases and congenital diseases in general. So if this actually has a big implication for the whole world and the whole disease state in general, and disease is a very big thing to take on. And a lot of people wonder how we could be so savvy as to take on disease in general. But a lot of the diseases that we get in our lifetime are actually diseases of biological aging. And so this is one of our big targets. So if we actually go after biological aging as a disease, rather than going after cancer independently, heart disease independently, Alzheimer's and atherosclerosis, things like sarcopenia, if we go after the aging of the cell, we actually find that we might have be able to knock out these symptoms in one fell swoop. And one fell swoop may be multiple therapies, but we're looking at the cell in a very different way than we used to.
Liz, let's back up a little bit a second, because you didn't, you know, you weren't born with this interest. You know, as a child, were you a very inquisitive, curious child? Like, what were you like?
I think I was. I think what was really interesting about me as a child, now BioViva works with all human gene sets, so I should just tell you that. But as a child, I kind of saw the limitations of the human body, and I thought we were more than our parts. And I thought, well, what was really holding us back from being able to jump like a horse or run long distances like a dog or things like that? And I always kind of hoped, without thinking on the realm of superpowers, that I could do those kind of things. And I thought that people inherently should be a bit different from one another than they are now. And I think in the future, that sounds really projected, and this is more projected. I think in the future, we'll probably will choose for independent traits more so than we think that we could do now. Now, that's really outside of what we do right now. What we do right now is very level-headed, it's very pragmatic, and it's very possible. Mm. These things will be possible in the future, but we don't have the technology to do that at this time.
So right now, where are we at? You can replace a single gene, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we actually don't replace a gene right now. We add a gene.
Okay.
And so some of the things I just talked about, we can actually test on or touch on, sorry. We have a myostatin inhibitor, and it can make you more muscular. So certainly you're going to jump a bit higher. You're going to run a bit faster. You're going to be a bit stronger. We have things like this that we have working already. But in the future, you know, we're definitely going to have probably even more switches in phenotype, I would think.
So if I see you in the Olympics, you know, next Olympics, I'll know what's going on there.
Yeah, if I look 20 and I'm winning the Olympics.
Like I see Liz Parrish on TV, I'm like, Liz Parrish.
Yeah, I think that we've probably gone entirely off topic now, haven't we? But yeah, I think that we will have the opportunity and the pleasure to actually bring people back to more youthful states and make them hopefully stronger, smarter, more visually accurate than they ever were before. And so that's a real improvement to the situation. We want to improve the human body so that we don't actually just go down the same route of aging and cellular degeneration.
So when did you form this company, and when did you get into this specific area of interest?
So let's see. I think that I've been always interested. I think that I've always been interested in biology and sci-fi all of my life. And it's funny how many people come through that route. It's really the people with the big imaginations who imagine something before it can happen that sparks everyone's desire to do better. This company was actually formed just January 2015. It was a couple years in the making, so it didn't just come out of thin air. It had a lot of time and thought and effort in collaborating a team behind it. I was thrust into this most recently about 3 years ago when a child I cared very much about became sick. And I ended up in Children's Hospital. And actually, it wasn't the first child I knew to become sick. I actually have a few friends who had kids with immunological diseases and various other problems. But this time, I ended up in Children's Hospital with this child. And I looked around and I thought, you know, I know we've come farther than this. I started asking around at the hospital what they were doing with stem cell work and genetics. And I was surprised to find out that it's such a big hospital, one that's known for being on the cutting edge, that they weren't doing any of those things, not for this disease type. And I felt like it really was it was a command in my mind that we couldn't proceed this way any longer. That these kids that were around me were dying, and they had no option, and they weren't going to see any of their firsts. And I felt like we should be pioneering much, much more quickly. I knew at that point that a lot of stem cell work was going on at Harvard and Stanford, but a vast majority of it was being done offshores. And I questioned that, you know, why are we seeing such good results, but we don't have any options for these kids right now? Why is it okay that they're dying? Why is it okay that we're letting them go? Why are we calling, you know, certain forms of medicine, experimental medicine, when everything that's come through the FDA, we're dying while we're taking? It's failing these kids. I think that we could do better than that. So that put me into a catalyst of traveling to genetic conferences. And I ended up at a SENS conference at Cambridge in the UK. Mm-hmm. And it was a genetics conference. And I thought, I think this is where the cure for these diseases is going to lie. And it was a longevity conference. And I thought, well, this is actually pretty shallow. I thought, you know, why are people trying to live longer when we're actually losing our kids? But I decided to keep an open mind and to sit through it. And I don't know, day one or day two, with the jet lag on top of me, it just really hit me that this was going to be it, that we were going to take on aging as a disease, that we were losing over 100,000 people a day to aging diseases. Each one of these persons has the potential to step up for a therapy that may in fact save their life, and that we could use these technologies to save these kids. And I just, you know, I started, I hit the ground running and refused to stop.
Wow. I mean, you've been called, some people call you the fire starter, right?
Yeah. And I think that that really comes from my, my ability to just look at the situation in a really different way. You know, I think that regulation is important. Safety is important, but at the same time, regulation and safety is killing people. Certainly, if you look at the history of gene therapy, you know, there was one real visible case of one person who died of gene therapy, and it really shut the industry down. This was a person who was really too sick to take the gene therapy and shouldn't have taken it to begin with. And it was a viral vector that gave an immune response, which was a double whammy, and it killed the kid. But every year, you know, upwards of over 100,000 people die of adverse drug effects. And these are from prescription medicine that's taken as prescribed. And, you know, this is completely covered up. You know, it's covered up under ADE, adverse drug effect. No company is held liable. Not to mention, like I said, you know, if you have atherosclerotic plaques and you take statins, you're very likely to die of heart disease, regardless of those statins. And they have a myriad of side effects. We believe that we can actually solve this at the genomic level, that we have genes that we can upregulate. We're looking at one right now that we already have working in humans. And we have some anecdotal data. It's only a couple people, but it appears to reverse atherosclerotic plaques. And it has a myriad of health benefits on top of that. It treats sarcopenia, which is the muscle loss over years. And so, you know, sarcopenia causes frailty. You lose muscle mass, you fall down, you break your hip. That's 7% of the population. Atherosclerosis, if we're right, is heart disease. That kills over a third of the population. What we're saying is that the data is out there. We're going to create more data. And if we're sitting on cures, it's time to stop doing business as usual. It's time to cure people. Health, actually, I don't believe that health should come at a cost. Right now, these therapies are massively expensive. People have to pay top dollar to get them from us. Probably the most expensive therapy that we would ever come out with, most of that would go into building the gene therapy, and I could tell you which one that is, but not all of them are that expensive. But at the same time, I can't really advertise prices because we work outside of the U.S., and yeah. So, you know, but the thing is that you can get the cost down to that. We're trying to target every cell in your body. For some of the gene therapies, you can just target a much lower amount and have the full benefit. So the difference between gene therapies, I don't know if your listeners would be interested, but some proteins that genes make, so genes make proteins and proteins make you, and that's the most simplistic way to think of it. Some proteins are shared outside the cell, okay? And when they're shared outside the cell, your body doesn't need to make as many of them because it's shared for your whole system. There are other proteins that are not shared outside the cell. As a matter of fact, they degrade if they go outside of the cell immediately. So we have to target nearly every cell in your body. And that's really only one gene therapy that we're looking at right now.
Doesn't every cell have a copy?
Do they have a copy of the gene?
Yeah.
So the two gene therapies that we're working with right now that we're pushing forward first are genes that your cell has a copy of.
Okay.
One of them is turned off, it's repressed,
right.
And the other one downregulates as you get older.
Right, right. So this is just blowing my mind that this is we're having this conversation and this is really happening.
I know.
Because
a lot of people go, oh my gosh, wow. So when is somebody going to do this? And then I say, you know, our doctor actually did it 5 years ago.
Right. I remember I heard you, you talk about that, and you said he's, at least a year ago, you said he's doing really well.
Oh, he's doing, yeah,
he's
doing,
still doing
excellent.
Well.
He's doing well. You know, he's recently had his CT angiogram. He has zero plaques in his arteries.
Get out of here. Wow.
He's in fantastic shape. He, he's able to just get up and do what he needs to do. You know, he can go and run, he can go and jog, he can go and hike. And, you know, he's in his 40s now, which is not too old. Most of us can still do those things, but, you know, he can do them with a certain eloquence that the rest of us who don't have the advantage can't do for sure.
So, you know, where I come from this is, you know, understanding the genetics foundation of motivation and behavior, cognition. And so I, you know, there's fascinating research, you know, looking at twins separate at birth, try to quantify the distinction between how much are differences in a certain trait influenced by nature versus or genes versus the environment. A study came out recently looking at academic motivation. So let's just take academic motivation, for instance. And you see that it's entirely that there's a very, very strong genetic basis to the desire to learn academic material. And the only thing that is non-genetic is unique, the unique variance to each individual person, not the shared variance by the two twins. Meaning that like in an educational classroom, it seems like academic motivation is strongly influenced by a combination of the genes that are shared by the two twins and the unique interaction of the genes with the teacher. And that knowledge is very interesting to think about. And what if we like found what those, you know, there are going to be a lot of genes interacting with each other, and there's going to be epigenetics at play, et cetera, but we've discovered what all those genes are. I mean, is it foreseeable at all in the future that gene therapy could act on things like academic motivation?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it will. I think that there is a lot that we have to learn. So one of the genes that we're looking at now is obviously the CLOTHO-VS, which is associated with higher IQ.
Right.
What's interesting is what they found with that gene is that if you have one, you have a tendency to live longer. They think that it might have to do with something with the reasoning system of the brain.
Wow. Research. Sorry to interrupt you a second. There is research showing that IQ is correlated with longevity.
Yes.
Yeah.
But this is interesting. Other people have said that if you have two of the copies of that same gene, you're more prone to depression. So it would be interesting.
Some of the most famous existential philosophers of all time could have told you that.
I work with a lot of people who are like that. They're pretty motivated people, but they have an underlying
angst.
Yeah, underlying, is this really it? And I think it's because they're so smart and their brains work so fast. Luckily, I'm not one of those people. So so I think that we will be able to manipulate the brain. Our company, before BioViva was formed, we formed out of a company called Neuralgene. And that company expressly was developing gene therapies to treat neurodegenerative diseases. And that's our first patent actually for BioViva came over from the doctor who worked for Neuralgene, and he brought the patent for the for H factor. It's essentially something that he found with using stem cells in patients with ALS and Parkinson's. So he's expressly worked with patients with ALS for, I think, about 6 or 8 months. And he was treating them with stem cells to the brain. Mm. And they were showing recovery within 24, 48 hours. They were showing the ability to have cognition that they hadn't, to have physical abilities that they hadn't had. People who hadn't spoken for 8 months, called him up within a week to say thank you.
Wow.
People who hadn't been able to stand up were standing up. Now, these were small feats, but they were big jumps. And he realized that there was no way possible that, you know, anything in the brain could be recovering in that quick of a time. That something else was happening. And he went deep into the research and created the first patent for what turns out BioViva. And that was the release of this H factor from stem cells. So when you take stem cells and you tear them out of one spot in the body and you throw them in another, one thing that they are doing is they're signaling, and they're signaling like crazy. Their job is to signal and say, there's damage, recover, recover. Mm. They suddenly get cells signaling that have gone dormant, or they have gone dormant for two reasons, maybe biological aging and maybe because of the disease itself. Things start signaling and you start to see this massive improvement. But all of those stem cells, almost all of them, if you track them, go leave the area. And it's true that within a matter of weeks to months, these patients regress back into their disease state. what's fantastic about this therapy is that it has the ability to maybe tackle ALS and Parkinson's, and we actually don't know. There may be uses outside of that. So the brain is a very important zone for us and something we definitely like to look at. We'd like to work with things like depression and various other things. I think that what we'll need, right now we have gene therapy, so we can insert in a gene. In the future, we'll have genetic engineering, right, where, you know, we're using kind of CRISPR type methods to cut things out and put good copies in.
Incredible.
And then in the very little bit farther off future, hopefully closer than we think, we'll have genomic engineering. And I think that's really what you're thinking of, is when you're thinking of, you know, all of the chromosomes working in harmony. Will we have to switch a chromosome out? Will we cut, you know, half of one off and replace it with something good and half of the other? When we look at all the genes and how they're essentially making music together, we find all the bad players and switch them out. That will be genomic engineering. And that is when our future will be much more bright than it is now. But right now it's looking pretty good.
Maybe think of a movie I saw recently. You probably know exactly what I'm talking about. That where there's this like beauty company that they say that they will make you look much younger. And what they actually did is they just replaced all the genes, and the person was not the same. And you know, and the son was like, "Where'd my mom go? Where'd my mom go?" And it raised lots of, I don't know. Did you see this movie? I wish I could remember the name of it.
No, I didn't. You know, the thing is, I rarely ever watch a movie. My friends will say, oh, she's only going to watch one movie this year, so we have to choose what that movie is. And so I see very few movies, and I don't watch TV. And I think that it's cute, because I often, you know, people will say, oh, what you do reminds me of this movie. And I always look at them and I say, now I want you to be the movie you want to see. Like, right, go out there and do something great. Because, but I do appreciate movies. I mean, I do enjoy it whenever I do sit down to one. I just don't do it very often. So I wish I knew what that was.
Totally fair. That's totally fair. I can't say I really enjoyed this movie that much, but it did get me thinking. You know, if we ever got to the point where we could kind of genetically engineer, or copy like an entire, like the entire genome, you know, how similar would I be?
It is a good question. And it, you know, it has to do with phenotype. And so we know we can increase your muscle mass, right?
Right.
But we don't know that we can change what your nose looks like. Those are really big, big, intricate problems that we don't have time to look into now. Of course, we would love to have time to look into that in the future. That would be a lot of fun. And that's why we're trying to knock aging off and pass that on to free cures for the world. And then we can work on the more fun aspects of the genome. I will never be done. It's just far too big to ever be done. But I do wonder about that myself. You know, what can we change? We can probably change pigment and things like that now. So with gene therapy, that, you know, the great thing about it right now is we can add a gene, and that sounds, in comparison to genomic engineering, so weak. But the great thing about it is we don't risk your body not identifying those other cells. And so there's the possibility of changing out massive parts of your genome. But if you think about it, we don't really have the technology right now to not only do that, but to keep your body from rejecting that. So if I, you know, shove my blood into your system, your body's going to try to eradicate that. So in the same way, if we were eloquently able to change a bunch of your genome and didn't change all of it, you know, one part of your body would be attacking the other body, much like an organ transplantation.
Right, right. You just made me think of that Russian man who had agreed to have his head or something put on another person's body. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did see that. I'm really proud of him for being a pioneer. I think that we have to come into our pioneering spirit. I think that we have to realize that there may be something to lose to make a better future. Now, gene therapy is a lot less threatening than a head transplant. As a matter of fact, there are hundreds of people going through clinical trials of gene therapy right now, and no one's dying. People don't die from the gene therapy anymore. As we work into new gene therapies, there may, in fact, be a likelihood that some of them will be unknown what exactly will happen with them. But this is done so carefully that I don't think we'll have that. But I'm really proud of him being a pioneer for that. And I think that somebody said something that made sense to me. I saw it in an email stream. They said they shouldn't be calling this a head transplant. They should be calling it a body transplant or something like that, because actually, grossly, he's achieving a brand new body onto his head. The outcome, this will be a fascinating process to watch. I can totally understand why he wants to do this. I'm really surprised that about people who cling so tightly to life that they can't see how someone who can think clearly but can't use the rest of their body would want to just go on in that state, a state that will inevitably kill them.
You sound like you have immense compassion.
Oh yeah, that's that. I have, people often ask me, because this is a longevity company, they're like, so are you afraid to die? I'm not afraid to die. I'm not afraid of death for anyone. I am immensely shattered by suffering.
Yeah, I get that. It comes through so clear. And also that you want to increase the quality of living. You say something, how we die has everything to do with how we live, right?
Yeah, it does. It has everything to do with how we live. And the more humanity that the world has injected into its veins makes a better world. We've seen that over and over again. If you look at the industrialized country, how they treat their animals is changing, how they treat each other, how they feed the rest of the world. We inherently get better the better our lives get. And I think that humanity would get a big boost up from eradicating a lot of these suffrage from these diseases. They do not create a humane world. And you can see that gentleness leave someone as they become diseased and as they become more and more in pain. And that just, you know, there are so many sayings that I think need to be knocked down, because they're really ideas of the lowest common denominator. I mean, I think that we reach so low today in society that, you know, we comfort ourselves with sayings like, oh, you only get what you can handle. You know,
right.
Talk to a family that has a kid who's sick or a kid who's dying. They can't handle it. There's just nothing else they can do but go on. You know, you don't drop dead because you're handed something you can't handle. You know, people say things like, well, on your deathbed, you'll wish you would have worked less. You know, that's not true. That just means that you did something that you didn't actually have a passion for. We should work more. We should try to achieve everything we can in this world, and we should incorporate the people that we love into that. If we really loved what we were doing, then they would be incorporated into our lives. We must work. We must achieve. We must get things done. We should not be sitting around and you know, working on this low standard of achievement that, you know, a lot of the world is starting to have.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like sycophant here, but that sounded very poetic.
what did it sound like?
Poetic. It was very aesthetic. Uh-huh. Like everything you just said was very aesthetically pleasing to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I mean, you're a doer, and I think that it's not inherently a person's fault if they're not.
Yeah.
But what we need to nurture for each other, for our communities, is passion. And passion and being able to pay the bills should go hand in hand. And so I think that that's, you know, I often, you know, people do, they give me names like Firestarter and things like that, because there's a lot wrong with society, and we sort of need to burn and raise a lot of ideas to the ground so that we can start over. so that we can start over with, for instance, this is one big pet peeve that I have, is safety and efficacy equals, you know, $1.5 billion in the U.S. So to get through the FDA, you need to raise about $1.5 billion now. And I hear that that's increasing all the time. But actually, money and safety and efficacy shouldn't have anything to do with each other. They're actually two different things. And it's a problem that people have separating those things. I've had people say, no, you know, you have to go through the system. And I'm, well, why should it cost so much? Why should saving a life cost so much? Some of the therapies that we work with are very hard to patent. Okay, so you can't patent a gene, and the viral vectors have been patented. And people will say, well, you can't make a company, you can't treat people with unpatentable therapies because, you know, where do you make your money? Well, actually, you can make money by treating people. You can do the right thing by treating people. Those two things just don't go together. We have to stop this mentality of patent, shut the other guy out. When it comes to cures, that is not where we should be. That's a nutraceutical thing. That's a pharmaceutical thing. But pharmaceuticals and nutraceuticals sit to the left, okay? There's nutraceuticals. They were very powerful for their time. They still work. There's vitamins and minerals and various things there. Then there's pharmaceuticals, and they're like a bumped up nutraceutical that basically has a bunch of side effects, and some of the side effects help us with disease states, and a lot of them don't. A lot of them make us feel terrible. But those are all on the left. Those are all marketing products, okay? On the right should be the cures, and everyone should have access to those cures. Those cures should be free for the world, and there should be no debate as to whether a company is doing the right thing or whether a company can make money doing that. Of course a company can make money doing that. As a matter of fact, if you hold the cure for atherosclerosis, just check out what you know, how much money statins make every year. And if it's not even a patentable idea, it's just a therapeutic that you're giving, you could as well. We try to drive the cost as low as possible, get them as close to what it costs to actually have a therapeutic made for the human body so that we profit very little so that we can move the data forward. But of course, we want these to be free, which is a lot cheaper than than that in the future. We have to come up with a new idea. And the new idea is just a completely different way of thinking. And there's always going to be a market for pharmaceuticals. And there's always going to be a market for nutraceuticals. As a matter of fact, when everyone's beefed up on gene therapies and living youthfully to 120 or whatever it is, whatever their target goal is, and living just how they want to look and just how they want to feel, I guarantee they're still going to take nutraceuticals. They're going to want to make sure they're maximizing everything. They're going to continue to take aspirin in their pharmaceuticals.
Wait, hold on.
There's enough room for everyone here.
So you said there's so many things unpacked there, but hold on. How long are we talking here that we could actually, people could live? Like, I mean, we could actually decide, like, we want to live 300 years?
Well, we, you know, what our company does is we say, we look at a human and we say, potentially you can live to 120 years. We're saying that that might be a human potential. We want you to live youthfully, well, strong, visually accurate, just right to the end of 120 years. We are posed with a question, and a question that we'd rather have you answer than us. And that is, if you're healthy, what do you die of?
Right. That's exactly the question, right? What are you dying? What are you dying of? I mean, like, other than like getting hit, run over by a car or, what are you dying of? So isn't it technically possible that this would make, like, if you like took yourself and like locked yourself in a shack for 500 years, could you actually live that long?
Well, we know that the human body actually likes to be worked. So if you put a car away like that, you might actually preserve the car as long as you didn't put gasoline and oil into it. But human bodies like to be worked. We don't know how long people could live. We would definitely like to find out. We would be thrilled to find out. And I hope that it's a very long time. Some of the charts that I show during one of my presentations shows the normal way to die. And so this is something that we had talked about before, but we didn't elaborate on. So what's normal? Okay.
Yeah.
the normal way for humans to die is before the age of 30 of infectious disease. This was normal all the way up to the advent of antibiotics and immunizations.
Am I right that like 90% of people died from infectious disease?
Oh, absolutely. So the one graph that I have, the plague was actually rampant that week that we took that data from. But if you look 100, 200 years before or after that graph, still about 90% of the population is dying of infectious disease. So that is actually what we normally die of. So when people say, well, dying of aging is normal, I call it a situational opinion. It's only normal in your lifetime. You know, in your grandparents' lifetime, that actually wasn't normal. In your great-grandparents' lifetime, that certainly wasn't normal.
Right.
That's a good point. I think that what the graph is going to look like in the future. So right now, so infectious disease used to kill about 90% of the population. Now it kills 3% in the U.S. in an industrialized country. I think that, and then the rest of the graph is, you know, heart disease, nephropathies, cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes type 2, things like that, frailty and accidents. So that takes up the rest of the chart. I have a feeling that in the future, and this sounds very grim, but if you think about it by the numbers, it's very different. I think in the future, the graph is going to go look like the old graph. It's going to go back to look like the graph from 1665, where 90% of the population are dying of infectious disease. The difference will be that those people will be, I don't know how old, three digits, maybe even four digits old, whereas the people in the 1665 graph are obviously 30 and under.
Wait, four digits? You're saying someone can live to 1,000 years of age?
We really don't know, but what we do know is that if we reset cellular division, if we reset epigenetic expression to youthful states, and then if we upregulate the proteins that will help the body clear atherosclerotic plaques, clear misfolded proteins, if we get the system to the point where it's behaving better than it ever did. Okay. Yeah. A lot of people think when I talk about aging as a disease that I'm picking on people over 30 or I'm picking on people over 50. It's usually like 10 years older than however old they are because they don't want to associate.
Right.
But actually you're born with aging as a disease. And so it's that accumulation of damage that's going on that leads to your end stage disease. And now more and more they're finding that you can actually look at the human body of the 20-year-old human body, and you can see symptoms, signs and symptoms of probably what will kill them in the future. I know that they're finding Alzheimer's as early as the 20s. Atherosclerotic plaques can start building up as young as 10. Mm-hmm. Cancer is something we see in human bodies from about the age 5 and up. It's just at about 65 years of age, your risk of mortality from cancer goes up about 85%. We think that has everything to do with the immune system. The immune system just isn't catching it anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
But all of these things are accumulating over time. You're developing cancerous cells, but the immune system clears it out. So it's just a matter of time to when your immune system isn't as strong and doesn't clear them anymore. But we're seeing this accumulation of damage and misfolded proteins. What we have to do is we have to create almost a better human. So we can do this with human genes. We don't think that we have to look outside the human genome, although some people are really excited about doing that.
Do you mean right? Like robots?
Do we want what?
Do you mean like robots? Like
machine? No, I mean with actually genes from other creatures.
Okay. I didn't know if we were going there for a second.
Yeah, some people want to be like, you know, cat. Half cat or something like this. You know, we don't know what the advantages would be, but we wouldn't touch that right now because one thing we would not want to do is open up the human genome to any sort of diseases, right?
Right.
So we wouldn't want to make humans into vectors that might make other people sick. We just want to use human genes. We've got enough of them and see what we can do now in a safe way to get people healthy. And then that's the whole point. So if you're healthy, if you're honestly healthy. I'm not talking about when you're 85 and you go in for an exam and then you come out. People tell me all the time, they're like, well, I was told I was healthy at my last exam. I'm 85 and my doctor said I was healthy. Well, he wasn't comparing you to me, and he certainly wasn't comparing you to a 17-year-old. He was comparing you to another person who's 80, okay? So, you know, so if you're truly healthy, not just what your doctor might tell you today, what do you die of? We don't know.
Gosh, it's so fascinating because, you know, you show this one chart that was so interesting, showing that between the ages of, I guess, you know, 15 and 30, our chances of dying from disease is about 0%.
Yeah, it really is.
And if we can reset, can you reset every like 30 years? Can we reset you back to that point?
So that's what we're talking about that now. So what we're talking about is whether some of these gene therapies should be transient gene therapies, meaning that we insert the gene, it only lasts for a limited amount of time, or it only, if you want to think about it, is it only codes for that protein for a certain amount of time and it leaves your cell, or if they should be upregulated permanently.
Right.
Our company is kind of masters of the permanent upregulation. We're a bit of survivalists. We like that idea, but transient gene therapies definitely have their value. And so with a transient gene therapy, that would be something where you would come in, you know, maybe every 10 years and you would get a gene boosting therapy. One of the reasons we don't like that right now is because we don't want you to have an immune response later down the road. So
right.
To the genes themselves, you won't have a response, but to the vectors that we use, you might. And so if we did something every 10 years or so, you know, you would probably have to take an immune suppressant in order to take it, because your body would get tipped off to some of the viral vectors that we're using. And we wouldn't want that response. That response might also knock genes out that we inserted. So, you know, that's hypothetical. But so a one-time gene therapy, I think, is the optimal.
Right. At least for now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it painful to inject a gene into what would it feel like?
Oh, no. It's not painful. I mean, it's painful in the sense of an intramuscular injection.
Gotcha.
Is not comfortable. So the difference would be, okay, if you don't have any indications that would make you need a diabetic type needle, then it might be hard to explain that to you. But for people who take human growth hormone, for people who are type 2 or type 1 diabetics,
gotcha.
They use a really small needle, and it's just a subcutaneous needle, and it doesn't really have much pain at all associated with it. An intramuscular shot like we give is more like it's like an immunization. So yeah, you're going to have some soreness in that area, but you know, it's like I've said before, if we're right about the myostatin inhibitor that may reverse atherosclerotic plaques, that would be 5 shots in each of your legs. So that's 10 shots total, but then you won't get open heart surgery. You know, you would be protected against those things. You would be protected against broken hips. I think that the amount of discomfort would be completely acceptable.
I would say so. Certainly seems like it. You said you hope to have evidence of age reversal by 2016. Are you still on course for that, do you think?
We are still on course for that, and we are very hopeful. And I would love you to check back in in the next few months. So we are on course for that. We're a little bit afraid now it may slip to spring of 2016, but we're definitely still have 2016.
Well, look, if I win the lottery like tomorrow, like $50 billion, I'll be checking back in with you on that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I want you to definitely, come in funding the company. We'll make, you know, 10 times your money back in the next 5 years. We'd be happy. We actually don't need very much, actually, to get going comparatively to companies who are trying
to do. Tell me how much you do need. Like, tell me what would be helpful if someone was listening to this podcast that's independently wealthy.
Oh, well, how wealthy are they? Let's see. Now, so actually, we need about $2.5 million would get us to profit. They would be very happy with that profit. The whole idea is to build labs, and there's two ideas. It's $2.5 million. We can build labs to get the cost down on the therapies, and we can start treating people.
That doesn't seem like that much. I was expecting you to say a lot more.
But really, the full Monty deal is not much more, is $4.5 million total, because we'd like to bring in an extra $2 million to run two offshore clinical trials at FDA standards with an IRB.
Wow.
So that we can run our therapies directly with 10 patients. You know, that would be our cohort that are absolutely diagnosed with one group with atherosclerosis and the other group with Alzheimer's.
Right.
And that is where the big push would be. It's to get that money. So it's to get the whole $4.5 million so we can run the two clinical trials. We can prove what we've got.
Right.
And that would be a beautiful, beautiful start.
So I'm just thinking, like, in the future, what if you prove this stuff is and it gets FDA approved? And, you know, why wouldn't we have universal health care for this stuff? You know, I as a taxpayer, I certainly wouldn't mind. I don't think taxpayers would mind if they would be able to personally also be able to experience this, right?
Well, as a matter of fact, taxpayers should save a lot of money. The government would save a lot of money.
Right.
Everyone would save a lot of money.
Seems a no-brainer to me.
Yeah. So right now we've hit the silver tsunami in the United States. And as a matter of fact, for the whole world. So now you have to picture this. You got to put your mind around the whole world. And we're talking about first world countries. We're talking about the most populated places on Earth. The whole world by 2020 crosses the silver tsunami. And what that means, there's more people over 65 on the whole planet than there are under five.
Wow.
The under five group are really important group because they're the workforce. They are the force that is going to come up paying for the healthcare costs of all these aging people. And there are so few of them compared to the 65s and over that they cannot afford it. So if you have people living to 120, but they're retiring at 65, half of their life, they're not working, they're not productive, and it gets worse from there. They're going to accumulate massive debt, and the government is going to have to pay for massive amount of health care. So just over one presidential term, one four-year term, the government could save something like $5 trillion on health care if we eradicated the diseases of aging.
Cow.
At that point, you know, I know a friend of mine, Bill Andrews, wrote a book, and in his book, he said that the government could afford to pay you midway through life, full pay, 10-year sabbatical, where you could retrain, travel the world, do all the things you needed to do, preparing for your second half of life, what job you would have for the second half of your life, with the money saved.
You should write a book. On this stuff. Did I hear somewhere that, like, right now you could, for $1.3 million, you could save your eyesight?
So that there is a genetic cure coming out for eyesight, and it does run around $1.3 million. So that is for macular degeneration. And, you know, this is something that, you know, BioViva could do for a fraction of that cost, maybe a fifth of that cost.
So, okay. I have a couple questions, and you know, I am very respectful of your time, so just a couple more minutes. Are you personally thinking of trying, and if that's too personal a question, you know, I apologize, but have you thought about trying any of this yourself?
I would actually like our company based on, built on, with all the people working in it, based on people who were, okay, let me formulate that again, because this is so crazy. I would like it if everyone who ran this company had taken these therapies. I would never make anyone take them, but I would like to see the people working with BioViva to be that committed to them, that we wouldn't give anything to you that we wouldn't take ourselves.
Right. And so that basically answered my question. Like, that includes you.
I would absolutely take them.
Yeah. Wow. So who else is in this space right now? So are you a leader in this revolution, so to speak?
I think that we are. So everywhere that I look around, no one seems to be equipped to make this move. Now, we did see this in offshore companies and medical tourism with stem cells. I guess that's the one of the businesses that's most closely aligned, although genetic cures are so much more powerful. I think that stem cells are wonderful, and there'll be areas that we will use stem cells, but actually creating a more substantial protected genome should be the fixative cure. There are not a lot of people in this zone. I don't know anyone else. I know a lot of people who talk about it, say that they're going to do it, say that they would like to do it. I don't know anyone else doing it.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. So how far off are we from genomic engineering? I know you said that's the future.
Genomic engineering, you should talk to our chief scientific officer about that. So his name's Avi Roy, and he's at Oxford, and he would know more about how close we are to that. That's a ways off. Right. And obviously right now we focus on what we can do right now with keeping our researchers' minds open to that sort of technology. But our researchers are all expanding into like CRISPR type technology now, and then more uses of gene therapy that we have available. We're very much a right now. What can we do right now? Sure. How can we intervene right now? How could we get people healthy right now who are dying?
Right. But you're simultaneously also a visionary.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I brought it up, because we will continue to expand. We will, as our company grows and as we have more money, we will want to bring on the best talent in the world. And actually, not just the best talent, but the most innovative people. That's a team that's worth so much. The team that we have are people who think outside the box. They're not worried about things like reputation, because they know that they're doing the right thing. Right. There are a lot of people that'll say, well, you can't do things this way because that's not how business is done. And we think that it's time to change business to make a better world.
Right. And it's just really nice to hear someone doing what you're doing. It doesn't seem like you're motivated by the profit margin or by any sort of, because when you see these kind of science fiction movies, people doing what you're doing are often painted as the bad guys. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. That's why I don't watch movies.
That's a good point.
When I talk about investors will be really happy with what we've got.
Yeah.
But when I talk about why we do it, the people who came together in this company, not one of us did it to come to live high on the line. Nobody came for a Mercedes or a mansion or anything else. We came to get the job done, and we're taking the big risk to get the job done, to make a better world, because actually I think that life would be a waste if you didn't do that. I don't have to live high on the line. I don't have to have big cars and big houses. That has nothing to do with my internal desire. Well, will the investors want that? They probably will. That's not our goal at all.
That's wonderful. Well, I wish you all the best, and it'd be great to stay in touch.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as informative and thought-provoking as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com.